Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our webinar presentation, Surviving and Thriving in the Wine Industry During Difficult Economic Times. Thank you for attending. This is part of a longer series where we've been talking about financial, business, and legal issues in the current economy. This particular webinar is really near and dear to us because it ties on our industry experience. Both Matt and I have been involved in the wine industry for now 2.5 decades as lawyers, and our firm goes back 40 years in the wine industry. So this is a topic that's near and dear to our hearts, and these are, in fact, somewhat difficult times. We're going to move through this presentation, and you have an opportunity to ask questions in the end. In addition, you can type questions to us at the bottom right of your screen. My name is Dean Gloucester. I'm a partner here and the head of our workout, restructuring, and creditor rights group. Matt Lewis, my partner here, is the head of our corporate group and works extensively with wineries. Matt, why don't you give us sort of what the agenda is today?
Sure. Just to follow up on what Dean just said, I would just mention that the first thing I ever did as a lawyer was workouts, starting to clean up the overhang from the Falcon Crest-inspired entry of a lot of people into the wine business in the late 70s and early 80s. So ups and downs in this business are no stranger to us. What we thought we'd cover is a number of things today. First, we were going to give a big picture overview of where we see things being today. A lot of this is going to be stuff you already know. This is our own idiosyncratic view of it. Some red flags to be aware of that would give you a hint that either perhaps your business or an aspect of your business or one of your customers or vendors' businesses is under stress, and therefore you need to be especially vigilant. Hints on how to manage customers, people who owe you money. Hints on how to manage your
joining conference.
So as to minimize some of the stresses in the current environment. And hints on how to manage your lenders and vendors, the people you owe money to, so as to preserve relationships and put yourself in the best possible position for survival and growth. We then wanted to talk briefly about what has traditionally been the kind of ultimate economic model in this business, the takeout model, the sale, and where that's sale, refinance, or restructuring, where that stands in the current environment. And then some opportunities for those who are well managed, have adequate capital, and have a strategic plan, you know, what is available to them right now. And then finally, I want to point out that we don't know everything. Okay, we see the different things that our clients see. We see different parts of the elephant, and we're very interested in what's on your mind. What are the issues you're seeing? What things you want to talk about? We have deliberately got a rather broad presentation here, so if there are ways in which we can frame or focus parts of the discussion, we'd be delighted to do so.
I think it's important to sort of understand that there's an issue in this industry. There are a lot of things that are similar to others, but there is a big issue in the wine industry generally, which is it's capital intensive, but frankly, all of the capital costs at the front end result in a luxury good that only gets marketed years later. And there are really three implications of that. One, there are high capital costs. Two, historically, there's a low return on assets and a long wait for the money to come back. And then three, it's actually difficult to do what a lot of other industries do, which is, you know, in those circumstances, you cut your prices to move your inventory because a huge portion of the value, whether you're a grower or a winery, has to do with sort of premium pricing and brand value, and that's something you can create lasting damage to if you're not careful about what you do to kind of get through today to get to tomorrow.
So following up on Dean's points, what this means is that there's an enormous amount of capital tied up in this business. Assets are expensive, and they need to sit and mature for a long, long time. Which leads in turn to choppy cash flow. Again, cash goes out a long time before the cash comes back in, and then as we all know, the cash flow is not even during the year. This puts a high premium on having access to both permanent and line of credit capital, usually through commercial lenders. And as we all know now, lenders, and I'm sure some of the lenders on the line will attest to, lenders are being appropriately cautious at the moment. We are seeing, although for good borrowers, we're seeing a lot of continued activity, but for others, we're seeing lower credit limits, tightened covenants. What we are not seeing as much in this cycle as we've seen in past cycles is the exits of lenders entirely from the business. I think lenders have learned that this is a business with long memories and that
joining conference.
The reputation of being careful about the business is ultimately a long-term damage for the lender. But again, for an individual borrower, things can be tight. In addition, operators are seeing a lot of different operating pressures these days. At least this is what we are getting reports. For growers, of course, the weather has been really interesting and it puts a lot of pressure on things. We've still got a juice glut from the last year or so, and it's not clear whether a shorter harvest this year will, how much of that will erase it. We are definitely seeing a lot of turmoil in the grape contract markets. People having their grape contracts renegotiated, having them terminated, getting notices of non-renewal. It's a very uncertain picture there right now. And many growers are concluding that their farming costs and their grape prices are very much out of whack, and that the opportunities for making profits on an operating basis are slim at the moment. For wineries, of course, the battle for shelf space continues, as it has for many years now. There continues to be consolidation in the distribution chain. Demand continues to be uncertain. And it is, I would actually be interested in intelligence on this. It was interesting the last couple of years, and hopefully everyone can hear me over the background siren right now. We've got operating windows in this building. In the last couple of years, a number of wineries, I think, and brands did better than expected because of a move among market tiers where there was essentially a move down to more of the middle market tiers in value and what were perceived as value brands. I think that gave many operations kind of some new wind behind them. I don't know whether that's going to continue or not and what the long-term implications of that are, but there's definitely turmoil in the market positioning right now. For everybody, I would say that the things we are seeing is when things get tough, there are two things you begin to see. One is how tightly you've documented your operations and you keep track of things becomes very important, and the flaws in even the best managed systems come to the fore. And two, you have to deal with people's natural tendency to deny that the situation might be worse than they think, which leads to delay, which leads to inappropriate decisions, and you both have to deal with it yourself and among those your counterparties. Finally, at the moment, we are also seeing great uncertainty about asset valuations. This means that this business has long had kind of what I would call the sports team model, the pro sports team model. You may lose money or not make much money on an operating and ongoing basis, but at least in the premium North Bay areas, you often made money by selling to the next guy. It's not clear that is going to continue, at least in the near term.
Joining conference.
And I think there are a couple of pressures that people need to understand. We're not just dealing with a recession, but a worldwide deleveraging and, as a result, tighter credits. So it's not just an issue that people are facing pressure on the cash flow front or the sales. It is that there is not the same availability of debt financing going forward. Money is available at lower loan-to-value ratios, and there are much tighter underwriting standards. What that means is, along with everything else, if you had a 2006 appraisal for your vineyard or your winery, that's not really relevant to what is going on in 2010. There are always outlier transactions, but a financial buyer is going to look at what is the projected and predictable cash flow in the future, and when that is uncertain or not a good number, it is going to be very difficult to sell that asset at a large number, which means that currently there's a pretty major mismatch between buyer and seller expectations. That is not unique to the wine business. You're seeing a ton of that in hotels and commercial real estate and in a lot of areas where a lot of money has been raised on the buy side with the expectation we were going to repeat sort of the Tax Reform Act and savings and loan implosion, and people would be able to buy assets at small numbers that would be worth a lot 2 years later. That's not actually happening, and there's just a big mismatch between what the buyer expects and the seller is willing to pay. At the bottom line, the numbers have to work for any financial buyer or investor. Matt, maybe you could talk about the existence of those folks.
There are, you know, we saw just before the latest downturn the entry of a number of financial advisors, private equity firms, other financial investors into this business. They are, we still hear about them being there. We still hear of interest. But again, they need to make some fairly aggressive return numbers for their investors, and their presence does not mean they're not going to carry the market. They are looking for good deals. Deals have to pencil out for them in a environment of uncertain asset values. That's difficult for them to do unless they see a demonstrable bargain. There are. We also ought to mention that there are two other types of buyers, as people well know, that have traditionally been in this business: the strategic buyers, the consolidators, the other brands, and then the affinity buyers. The strategic buyers, again, they're out there. We've seen a lot of some of the consolidating companies recently have been reorganizing. Some of the big wine companies, they have found it difficult to absorb all that they bought in the last few years. It's not clear that they're going to be enormously active. Some of the smaller, or not smaller, but less well-known brands are looking for opportunities, looking to fill out their portfolio, looking for bargains, but again, price is important to them. And then finally, in this business, it's always been the case, people love this business. People are willing to do a lot to get in this business, notwithstanding some of the daunting economics Dean mentioned earlier. But typically, you get the rush of affinity buyers, at least in our experience, and towards the end of a boom cycle, not at this stage of a down cycle. And in fact, we joke in our office that counting the number of people coming in to take their fortunes made somewhere else and put it into the wine industry, the more you see of that, the closer you're getting to the top of the cycle. But we're not even close to that yet.
And that's important because what you get in a business where you have sort of high capital costs and then you have substantial operating costs, but you've got very slow sort of turnover about a sales cycle, is that you have huge costs today and in a tight credit market, difficulty meeting those costs, either with revenues today or with simply borrowing to sort of get to the next month so that there's a cash flow squeeze. And there are a bunch of things that sort of come from that.
One thing you begin to see is suddenly disputes where people were working things out before. One of the classic ones, taking the grower-winery relationship, is from the grower's point of view, suddenly the grower is seeing wineries claiming quality issues where grapes are just not that different from the grapes that have been accepted before. Two or three things are happening in that case. One is, in fact, the winery is making a decision consciously or unconsciously to try to move its quality up market. That's a typical move to try to position yourself to survive and thrive, and therefore is being more picky than it would otherwise be because it wants to meet its new model for quality.
Joining conference.
The other possibility, of course, is this is trade bait for some sort of price break or other accommodation. It's a red flag for a grower, for example, if the person raising the quality issues is the CFO of the winery. That's usually a sign that we've got a difficult haircut negotiation coming up in our future. Another red flag is you're finding that the deals won't close. Your sales that normally would take a relatively short time to make are not being made. You were going to sell a portion of the winery, a portion of your land. You think you have a deal. It just never comes to fruition. You call, nothing ever gets done. That's a sign that something is going on there that you need to pay attention to.
And I guess our other point is sort of 2, 4, 6, 8, time to renegotiate. We're seeing an enormous amount of sort of renegotiation, particularly among great purchase agreements, that you've got great purchase contracts, and the buyer is saying, look, I understand what the contract said. I can't pay for those grapes, and I can't take them, and, you know, it's not going to work. I don't so much see that as a red flag as, you know, an appropriate response. When you can't actually do what people originally planned, it is very helpful and constructive to renegotiate, and we'll cover that in a little bit. That's better than just, you know, resonating silence when, you know, we're about to deliver, you are going to take them, right? Then you just get a voicemail. We think that there's an issue, and then they don't respond to you after that.
So in talking about the specifics of how to manage, how to behave, what to do, there's some guiding principles we at least tend to use, and this will inform the way we approach some of these specific problems. You know, other people may have different approaches, but here are the things we think are useful to bear in mind. First of all, this is a small industry. It's got long memories. The way you behave today often resonates years from now in how people will treat you, what opportunities come your way, and how deals go. So thinking about the long term, if you plan to be a long-term player, thinking about the long term makes sense.
But the flip side of that is don't get blinded by either the past or the future that you foresee. If you sort of say, well, I couldn't possibly do X because that would injure my brand value, so I can't drop the price even up in Canada to move that inventory or do this or consider a sale or consider bringing in more capital or doing any of these other things, you can really get yourself into much worse problems by not acting today to deal with really potential crisis situations and real present difficulties. And my experience in the last 25 years in dealing with sort of financially troubled companies and difficult financial situations for everybody is the one thing that you can be certain of is that there's an enormous amount of denial involved typically, and it's an incredible powerful force. You know, people wish, you know, if you got a 2006 appraisal, you say, well, look, it's worth that. That's the real value here. Or, well, look, I've got a contract that says I'm going to sell these grapes for this price and that amount of tonnage. And, you know, all of us have to deal with the actual reality that we face today. And the more quickly and constructively we can do that, the more effective the results are going to be.
Speaking of contracts, one thing that we often hear of in this industry is people saying, yeah, I know I signed X, but I really meant Y. Or we didn't put it down, but of course everyone understands that we want this to happen, or that there'll be this quality or this price, or these dates. At the end of the day, when you're talking about your contracts, you get the contract you wrote. You don't get the contract you wish you made. You don't get the contract that makes sense. You don't get the contract that some other guy got. You got what you got, which means make sure you've got the right business points. Make sure they're recorded. Don't just blindly take somebody else's form and make assumptions. Make sure you understand what you're working with. You are basically operating in an environment where there are a couple of points of leverage. One is the real economics, you know, who's got what to trade in order to make something happen. The other is what deal's already on the table. you know, what commitments have people already made. You're trading off of those two things. You want the contract you're trading off of to be what you intended to the extent you can.
And sort of coming up with a deal that works, it's critical to sort of have the incentives matched with what people ought to be doing so that the deals ought to align interests and incentivize people to do the right thing. And to do that, you actually have to understand what everybody's goals are and then what their leverage is. You know, but the truth is a secured lender doesn't really want to foreclose on an operating winery. It's not a good business. It's one thing if you're sort of taking over a hotel and there's an existing management company with a management agreement. Making wine is really difficult, and so it's not a simple
joining
matter of
conference.
Going to step in and do that. And then no matter what was sort of signed in the past, if you can't continue, regardless of what the piece of paper says, as a practical matter, you won't continue to do things that way. So, you know, recognizing a reality and making a practical business deal to take that into account and getting to the next year and then, you know, having a set of incentives where everyone sort of behaves in a way to maximize the value for all the stakeholders is what you want to do.
Another aspect of behavior to think about is how you actually interact with people under circumstances like this. Look, there's a lot of business pressure out there. And in this business in particular, people's names tend to be on the door. It's a reflection of themselves, their own aspirations. And so when there's stress, people often personalize it. And it's important to realize, ultimately, this is business. It's not personal. If you do personalize it, it's going to be that much harder to reforge a relationship, to come to an appropriate resolution, and to focus on the important moving points here. And as a subset of this, this is I stole this next point from another one of
joining conference.
And I thought it was absolutely brilliant because I've seen this happen over and over again. Something happens in the course of a negotiation or dealing with a broken contract or something, you get really teed off. You write a brilliantly incendiary email. Don't hit send. Wait a day. You want to be talking about the underlying business point, not what you said in the email. That cathartic email could cost you thousands of dollars and weeks worth of time in terms of litigation, in terms of people digging in their heels. So be very careful of that.
And then, you know, a corollary to that, or maybe a corollary on steroids, is that litigation is an expensive hobby. You know, I think in terms of sort of the law of evidence, what I'm about to say would be considered an admission against interest. But if there is not enough money to go around, spending a large chunk of it on lawyers is not the best business solution. So if you can avoid litigation, avoid litigation. There are generally, or almost always, more practical ways to resolve problems than, you know, our judicial system.
That statement will not be in our recorded version of this webinar, by the way.
One of the things that happens, and now we're talking about dealing with your customers, dealing with the people who owe you money. When you're in an environment where there's not enough money to go around, people simply choose to pay some expenses and to defer other expenses, which means that for vendors, for suppliers, you can be treated simply as an involuntary operating lender. And you're not really typically being rewarded to take that risk, and you're not getting paid to do that, and frankly, you're facing enough pressure on your own line of credit about, you know, your lender. So
joining conference.
If there's not enough money to go around to pay everyone, and someone is choosing who to pay and who to effectively borrow from, be the most expensive lender. Have a late charge. Charge people a late charge or interest if they're not current with their payments.
Or both.
And California courts have upheld, in the commercial context, a late charge of up to 1.5% per month. Also have an attorney's fees clause that allows you to get your collection costs if you have to collect from people. And it would be routine even if someone is late. Now they're, you know, 87 days out and the payment was 30-day terms. For you to waive the late fees and the attorney's fees or the collection costs in return for getting a check today, but it does get you leverage to get that check today.
And what this touches on is that when you're dealing with a business that's got some cash flow issues, there are really two shortages. One, which is apparent, is the shortage of cash, but the other typically is a shortage of bandwidth. People are managing under crisis. There's only so many problems they can handle at a time. And if you suddenly become the expensive or the noisy problem, your chances of getting their attention are much higher. And that's one of the key things you want to be doing is you want to be one of the few phone calls that gets returned.
And there, the bottom line message and kind of everything flows from that is act promptly, insistently, diligently, and professionally. So, you know, be the person who is contacting that customer, that debtor, that borrower, and make sure that you are being dealt with and being dealt with professionally, because simply ignoring the situation is not helpful. And, you know, the people who are insistent often do get paid. The people who are quiet don't get paid, and they will be very lucky to be thanked later.
So let's assume that you actually you follow up on this and you get you manage to reach your debtor and you work out some sort of deal. You string out payments. You do make some sort of accommodation to help them out. What should you be looking for in return? I mean, the short answer is, of course, is to improve your position. If you don't have a written contract, write it down. If there were points that were in dispute or confusing before, make sure they are clear. But there are some specific things you ought to be looking for following up on what we just said. One is, if you don't have a late charge provision or an interest provision or an attorney's fees provision, get it in. You don't want to be the other guy's bank again. And if there's going to be a fight or a dispute about something, you want it to be on his dime. An obvious one is cash on delivery or cash on release if you're doing, for example, custom crush. You know that credit is an issue. Why would you give up your primary piece of leverage without having the cash in hand? Sometimes, not always, but sometimes personal guarantees might be possible. If you are part of the critical chain for your customer's business plan, you may have the leverage to insist that whoever is behind, you know, whoever the sponsor is of the business, personally get on the hook. Now, there are two reasons for a personal guarantee. One is, of course, it's another source of recovery. It's also a source of litigation, so that you have to be you have to think carefully about that. But it also, again, if somebody's personally on the hook, you've got their attention in a way that you don't have if you're merely another creditor of a company in which they have a shareholder interest. So this is all about getting attention, getting people's focus, and personal guarantees are very helpful there in the right situations. Finally, security interest. If you are dealing with somebody's property, you're creating property, you're selling grapes, you're custom crushing, get a security interest in what you're doing, in the value you're creating. If nothing else, again, it gives you a chance to be a roadblock in the way to their realizing their value, gives you a source of recovery. It's an appropriate way to protect your interest, and it's very simple to do.
And there, it you know, growers are protected by growers' liens. There are certain processors' liens so that you have some basic protections just if that's the business that you're in. But if you're a glass supplier, you can actually go get, as part of your, you know, purchase agreement, a security interest in the glass you deliver, and then you can go record, you can go perfect that under the UCC by simply filing a UCC-1 form, which is a half page. And there, let me just say, assuming that you didn't do all of these things to protect yourself, so you don't have a late charge, you don't have an attorney fees clause, you haven't taken a security interest, when things go bad, there's actually an opportunity, if you're continuing the deal with one of your customers, to go professionalize the relationship at that point and say, look, you are over 45 days out, and we need to kind of sit down and, you know, you've told us that you're going to get us payment in 10 days. that's fine, but if we're going to continue to ship, you need to do that, and you need to sign this new version of the agreement that includes a late charge and attorney's fees and a security interest in what we're about to deliver you. So there really is an opportunity for that conversation in working with somebody. There are a couple of specific rights that you have, both outside bankruptcy and inside bankruptcy, but they require moving very quickly. That you can ask for reasonable assurances from your buyer that they're not insolvent and that they can pay for what they've ordered. And in fact, you can ask them, I would like an updated financial statement showing that you guys are solvent. That's helpful for a couple of things. One, you actually are dealing with people who can pay for what it is that you're sending them. And then two,
joining conference.
There is a right to reclaim under the Uniform Commercial Code. So in California, Commercial Code Section 2702 gives you a very short window of time. It's 10 days. If you've delivered to a customer and then and they can't pay because they're insolvent, you have 10 days to send them a notice and seek to reclaim your goods. Obviously, 10 days is not a real practical limitation, but if you've gotten a written assurance of solvency within the year prior to that, the 10 days doesn't apply. And then even in bankruptcy, let's say you sent something to someone and they filed bankruptcy 3 days later, if in the first 45 days of the bankruptcy you send them this written reclamation notice, you improve your rights. You essentially either get your products back or an administrative expense, which means you get paid 100 cent dollars instead of pennies on the dollar.
And we're not talking about some fancy, you know, odd legal thing here. I mean, we're talking about, you know, practical commercial behavior, sending a letter saying, look, we've been hearing in the market that you guys are having trouble. We are worried that we're not going to get paid for our grapes. Please let us know where you are and how you plan to pay for it. This is not something where you have to do backflips and set it on special blue paper or anything. Behave like a reasonable business person, and you can accomplish these things. I want to talk for a moment about grape contracts. And this is a big topic. A number of us in this firm give hour and hour and a half long presentations on grape contracts. I think we've got some materials that my partner, Rick Van Duzer, has prepared on this that if you get in touch with Margaret Poza, she may be able to send to you that will go into this in more detail. There are a couple of things I wanted to point out in addition to the more general points about behavior and about expectations and about leverage that we've been talking about. One is, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of activity in this market right now, and activity mostly in the sense of existing contracts, again, being renewed, dropped, not extended, modified, et cetera. And we're going to have to, as crush goes on, we're going to have to see how that all plays out. But clearly, there's a mismatch between the contracts in the market, and that is showing up. One thing to mention is how some of these discussions happen. There's a big difference in attitude, approach, and resolution when a change is proposed as a negotiation and when it's made unilaterally. Things that a grower, for example, might be unhappy but willing to consider if approached in a respectful negotiation are going to be much harder to accomplish done as a unilateral imposition by a winery, just as a general rule. I mean, this is just, you know, how people behave. I mean, let's be real. This doesn't apply necessarily, for example, if you are growing grapes in the Central Valley and your grape contract is with somebody whose name is, you know, 5 or 6 letters long and begins with G, and they unilaterally make a change, you kind of have to roll with that one. But for most wineries and growers, taking a more negotiated approach is generally works out better. Don't surprise people at the last minute. Give them a head start. Be upfront about what you need to do and why it's going on. People are going to figure it out anyway. And again, on either side, don't take it personally. Second thing I would point out is grape contracts can often be one of the most basic things you can do as a grower to improve your position in a grape contract is to make it a secured grape contract. That is, get a security interest in the grapes that you're selling. The documentation for that is surprisingly simple at its most basic. It's one or two sentences that can be added to a grape contract or a renegotiated grape contract. It would give you the right to file a UCC financing statement, which again is a simple form state, one-page form statement with respect to those grapes. And a grape, a security interest is different than supplements in as many ways an improvement over the statutory grower's lien, which has a number of limitations, not the least of which is it's not clear it attaches to proceeds, that is cash. It's very hard to enforce. I think people who have tried to enforce it find it a frustrating process, whereas a security interest can be enforced usually without court interaction. So it's a nice supplement. Finally, I would mention, and this is one thing where I'm more asking a question than presenting here, is traditionally when we have these situations where grape contracts get out of whack with the market, a very common deal is trading additional years in the contract maybe for a reduction in price now. I at least am not seeing much of that kind of trade right now, and given the uncertainty of the market, I'm not sure whether that's possible. Again, I'd be curious in seeing whether people are finding that to be a useful tool.
Joining conference.
That negotiation.
Michael.
So let's talk then about how you manage your business. We talked about how you deal with people who owe you money. Now we're going to talk about how you deal with things internally to put yourself in the best position, and then how you deal with people you owe money to. One thing I would note is problems seem to come up piecemeal, bit by bit, but after you get to a certain tipping point, they really need to be solved as part of an overall plan. The things you promise one person will have an impact on how you deal with somebody else, what assets are available, and what commitments you've made. So you really do need to step back and think about, how am I going to get through this if you're the one who is, feeling stressed? How am I going to get through this? What are my assets? What's my cash flow look like? What's my business plan? How can I sell this to everybody else? What commitments can I make? So you need, above all, you need to be realistic. You need to be timely. You need to be accurate. You need to know where your cash is coming from, when it's coming, not when you hope it's coming, but when you really think it's coming. What are your asset and inventory valuations? Again, you know, what can you do at a fire sale? What can you do at a Trader Joe's kind of thing? What can you do through the normal channels? Very careful.
And in that connection, cash flow is absolutely king. It's actual cash in the door, and you need to have projections showing where your cash flow holes are going to be. And in that connection, you really, it is a terrible idea to be borrowing from Uncle Sam and not paying your payroll withholding taxes. That there is personal liability for that, there are penalties and interest for that, that is not something you should be doing. In addition, you may have personal liability if you have employees who come to work when you are not going to be able to pay them and pay them upon severance. And that sort of raises the next issue, which is right-sizing your workforce, and the most common problem in a difficult economic environment is doing too little too late. That is particularly true of closely held businesses where the owner and manager is really in a position of sometimes letting go of people who are friends, who are your most loyal sort of folks you've worked with for years.
Joining conference.
Job environment. And, you know, the most common problem is doing too little and too late. And, of course, you know, if you make that mistake, then the consequences for all of those people that you employ are much worse. Then, you know, obviously anything you can do to accelerate revenue is very helpful in terms of cash flow. What I think a lot of people are doing is they're trying to figure out ways to do that while causing the minimum damage to brand value, the minimum damage to premium pricing. So the example would be, if you're a high-end winery, you simply reduce your price in one isolated market and you say, look, we're going to sell a whole lot of inventory in Canada. We're going to have a special program up there. We're going to move a lot of this stuff, but we don't want to mess with our price point or the perception of value elsewhere in the market. And, you know, the most critical issue is really making sure you're dealing with things on the front end to manage that cash flow, because, you know, we'll cover sort of at the back end sort of what the alternatives are if you can't pay your bills and someone with leverage really sort of comes in to tip you over. But it's not, you know, your alternatives are always way better the earlier you deal with things and the more carefully you know, it's a lot easier to dodge a hole than it is to climb out of it.
So if you, let's assume you've gone ahead, you've put your business in the best state it could be in. You are still experiencing stress. How do you deal with the people you owe money to, your lender, your key vendors? Remember, they are in the same position that most people in business right now and in this business are in similar positions. A lot of stress, typically dealing with a number of troubled customers one way or the other, limited bandwidth. How do you make sure you're getting the right attention when you need it? And I think that there are really a couple of keys here. You need to be seen as part of the solution and not yet another problem. You need to understand your creditors' issues and show them that you can solve them. And I think the keys here, and this is admittedly broad, but as a general rule, one, you got to know your own business. You have to be seen as a good and capable manager, you know, with a good and capable plan. And that means being honest, no surprises, being realistic, and being proactive. It's simply better if you can go to the people you're dealing with proposals, with presentations, than wait for them to go knock on the door and say, yeah, what's happening here?
And, you know, one piece of advice specifically in dealing with your bank, your secured lender, the opportunities for that conversation to go wrong are enormous, because they almost always do. Most people actually don't get the script right in dealing with a bank. They start down and sit down and say, you know, I want to talk to you because you're my partner. Well, the bank doesn't actually share in the upside of your business, and they're in a low margin business of loaning money, and they actually have to get all of that money repaid to them because they don't share in your upside. So when things go bad, telling them that you're their partner doesn't actually go well. But you can separate yourself from the great unwashed if you say, look, I actually have a plan to deal with this. I have a plan B and I have a plan C, and I'm well along with executing on those. And if plan A doesn't work, we'll move on to plan B. And I am actually managing this whole thing to make sure that we can repay you what we can. So, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
And a plan that doesn't work, by the way, is I'm going to sell this whole thing to a Saudi Arabian prince for a large amount of money, and I have no plan B.
Right.
That's not going to get you much traction.
Yeah, and just, no, well, you know, you lender can't enforce your remedies. That would sort of wipe out my ownership. Well, I'm sorry. That was the deal when you borrowed the money and granted the security interest. So it's important to be practical, and frankly, being practical and constructive and not in denial and having a plan will get you an enormously long way in having a constructive relationship with your lender once things are a little difficult. So you have to lead, avoid unnecessary surprises, make realistic commitments, and keep your promises, and then if the situation has changed because, you know, someone didn't pay you, the revenue hasn't come in, you got hit with a tax bill, there was a fire, whatever it is, communicate, and then if you have to, stretch your payables. And, you know, in sort of, if things are in extremis and you owe a whole lot of people, actually you can set up a universal payment plan. So it's not unusual to get a meeting with all of your unsecured creditors and say, look, we're not going to go favor some of you over others. We're, you know, here's the situation. Our secured lender's going to work with us, but, you know, frankly, there simply isn't the money to pay all of the current bills to all of you folks. So here's what we're going to do. On a going forward basis, we will pay all current bills first so people will continue to deal with us, and we will deal with the past due amount over time on the following payment plan, and you're all going to get treated the same way. And frankly, it works way better for you, our suppliers, you, our customers, you, our whoever, to work with us than to see us close our doors or have the bank foreclose or have, you know, spend what money there is on sort of dealing with litigation with one or two of you who are the most difficult. So those things actually typically do work reasonably well. You just have to be constructive and upfront, and you know, you need to put those things together. Your creditors are not going to organize it themselves and suggest that you pay all of them equally. Everyone's, you know, in it for themselves.
And there's an enormous premium in that scenario on spending a lot of hands-on time. Dean's absolutely right. There's actually a lot to be gained for the holdout lender, and so, or the holdout creditor, the holdout vendor. And so managing the process so people aren't tempted to do that and aren't gaming the system is really important. And that means basically being on the phone almost every day. It takes much longer than you would expect. It is much more difficult. It's well worthwhile.
But part of the organizing the process is time management and figuring out one way to communicate with all your creditors.
Anyway, there are all sorts of ways to do that. We'd be happy to talk offline about some of our experiences there. Let's talk long-term. You know, an alternative, of course, that traditionally happens in stress businesses is restructuring or recapitalizing. And wine business is no different. We actually have, I receive probably every week a couple of calls from people or inquiries about the availability of assets or availability of investment opportunities. But what you have to realize is everyone's looking for something cheap right now. And that brings up a couple of points. One is, you know, it's tempting to say, well, I'll just get a new partner. You need to realize that in reality, there's a tendency in this business to think of equity as being free. And unless it's your dad or your brother-in-law or something like that, equity is expensive. It's probably the most expensive part of capital. It expects the highest return. And so that's not necessarily the cheapest way to get yourself out of a hole, and you need to think carefully about what the expectations are and what that will cost you. There are also, in addition to the normal lenders, there are some non-traditional lenders out there that have been formed in the last 4 or 5 years that are looking for opportunities. You know, they're looking for mezzanine or similar opportunities. These are not cheap either, but they may well compare in the appropriate situation to new equity coming in. But in either case, you need to look carefully again and be upfront about what the return expectations are. And that means you need to have a good business plan that's going to create either operating value or an opportunity for a sale that will satisfy those expectations.
And in terms of a sale, I think it's important to understand the deal structures in an environment like today's where there's low availability of financing. You know, you're going to see carrier and seller carry back financing where there's a disconnect between the value of the buyer and the seller. You're going to see earnouts based upon sort of future performance, so a portion of the sale price may be substantially contingent upon future operating performance. You're going to find that buyers have to put more equity into the deal because there's going to be less debt financing. And then finally, you know, you're going to see, and this kind of combines the borrowing sources with the sale, kind of a loan-to-own model where someone comes in and says, well, look, I'm willing to provide you financing to kind of get you to this point, and I have a very high return expectation, and if you don't pay me, I'm essentially putting this money in because I'm willing to own your business by exercising my remedies, and that is, in fact, okay with me. And that's quite different. Banks don't really want to own wineries, but there are people who might. Let me just cover the insolvency bankruptcy issues in about 1 minute so we can stay on track and then talk about what some of the opportunities are. You know, frankly, if someone is facing an imminent foreclosure, a bankruptcy will stay a foreclosure. It will stay all litigation. But typically, bankruptcy is not a good solution because it doesn't improve your band value. It doesn't improve your operating cash flow. And attorneys are expensive, so it costs a lot of money to be broke. So in the right situation, that can be there can be some opportunities there. There are special powers in bankruptcy to deal with things like rejection of executory contracts. But for the most part, it's just a forum that has some tools. It is not a way to impose a business solution. Someone has to come up with a business solution, and bankruptcy may be one forum to accomplish that.
We've talked a lot about gloom and doom, but the flip side of that is that this may be a really opportunity-rich environment at the moment. I've sometimes thought that if I weren't so heavily invested in the American educational system right now, this would be a great time to set up a wine company. Assets are out there. In general, they seem to be cheaper to buy than to build for the right assets. There will be, notwithstanding the kind of lack of movement in the market right now, there will be fire sales of various people's assets, including some desirable brands. The loss of competition means shelf space opens up for people who are who've got a good marketing plan. So there are definitely things out there to acquire, to buy, to fill in holes in your portfolio. And to do so, again, at the right price.
So I think it's a sacred duty of when you put on a program to finish on time. So we've got 4 minutes left. I wanted to just cover a couple of things. One, there's a list here of some of the prior webinars that we put on in the last 6 months. And then we've got a couple of webinars that are coming up, which are on employment issues for companies in transition, and then restart techniques for technology and IP-driven companies. And let me sort of suggest we're going to have a couple minutes here for questions, but in addition, please feel free to email either Matt or I if you have any questions, or frankly, you know, we've mentioned some materials on great purchase contracts. Matt and I put together just a short piece about what you ought to put in your great purchase contracts these days. Matt and I recently did an article for the North Bay Business Journal about some of the same issues that we've talked about today. Feel free to follow up with either of us if you'd like some of those additional materials. And now I'd just like to toss it open if anybody on the phone wanted to take their mute button off and to ask a question real time.
So do we solve all problems in the wine industry?
Well, thank you all for your time, and thanks for joining us for this webinar, and best wishes in these challenging times. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, thank you so much for this. Dean and Matt, can you still hear us? I didn't click in quickly enough there. I'll give you guys a call. Hey, thanks again. This was great. Bye-bye now.